All right. If you'll open your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 4, 1 Peter chapter 4, a text was read for us, 1 Peter chapter 4, looking at verses 7 through 11. If you will notice just the end of verse 11 there, you will see that Peter gives what would be called a doxology or a brief statement of praise to God, common in a lot of the epistles. Paul does this as well. But this particular one signals, as he says at the very end, to him be glory for glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Signals for us that Peter has come to the end of the body of his letter and is now going to transition after this to a ending section of the letter. And I thought it'd be a good time just to note how Peter has then outlined his letter. The first chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 10, he has shown us who we are in this present world as elect exiles, which we spent quite a bit of time talking about. And then from chapter 2, 11 through 4, 11, as we will discuss today, he has shown us how to live in godliness in the light of suffering for righteousness' sake, and how to live then as elect exiles during this period. And then in the final section of his letter, from 4:12 through 5:11, he will then give us hope in the midst of even a greater trial that is upcoming. So that's the basic outline. It's unusual, we might think, for him to bring the body of the letter to bear here seemingly somewhat early, but he has taken it that way so you can save the last section to emphasize that the hope that we have in the midst of even a greater trial that seems to be ready to come upon them. So that is the idea. Now notice, of course, the words that are given there, that the culmination or the end of all things is at hand. I've used the word culmination in the title because that comes from the NET version, and I think gives us a good perspective of what's taking place here. The culmination of all things at hand. It's fair for us, when we read that, to think in terms of what would first century readers have thought the culmination or end of all things at hand. What end are we talking about? It would be something that, before we can draw any conclusions about it, we'd have to say, well, how are they looking at this? And if we know what Paul has said earlier about these things and what even the prophets said about what would come to pass, and then we add to this that the readers of 1 Peter are primarily originally Jewish readers, and that's evident, as we've talked about earlier, throughout the letter, that we would then be saying, what would Jewish people, Jewish Christians especially, what would they have understood then, this end of all times, or this culmination of all things, would actually deal with? Paul makes an interesting statement back in 1 Corinthians 7, when he, in that text, actually talks about such severe trials that are about to arise for them, that he urges them to not even get married, if possible. If you can keep yourself together, don't even get married. And he uses these words, the present form of this world is passing away. It is going to be such a serious thing that you are going to have an easier time if you don't marry. This would be a better way to live your life. And even as a married person, it is going to be a real challenge. So Paul mentions that even in his time. And then we would note as well, in Daniel 9 and verse 24 through 27, Daniel talked about end times, using those words actually, talking about the coming of the end, but his end was the destruction of Jerusalem. His end in Daniel 24, Daniel 9:24, is talking about the culmination of all things in which Jesus comes and the final prophecies of those times are fulfilled, including the abomination of desolation. Remember Jesus quoting that from Daniel 9 in Matthew 24, the abomination of desolation coming and the whole world really just turning upside down. There's a huge change that takes place at that point. Now, you say, well, what would the destruction of Jerusalem have to do with these people who are Jews indeed, but living up in the Asia Minor area, northern Asia Minor area, Bithynia, etc.? And what would it have to do even with Gentile Christians? Well, AD 70 is a markedly turning point in Roman history and in especially history for believers. It's a turning point for Jews because it was the ultimate destruction of their nation. Rome had come to the point where they were just simply no longer tolerant of the Jewish independent spirit, the Jewish spirit of "we hate you, but if we could overthrow you, we would," and constantly causing trouble in all of the cities in which they lived, and especially in Jerusalem. And Rome had just had it; they were filled up with it, and so they fulfill exactly what Jesus and God intended for them to fulfill, and that is the destruction of God's own people, if you will, no longer his people because of their disobedience. But this triggers other things too. As the empire moves more and more to the emphasis on Rome as being the ultimate authority, the ultimate God, if you will, and even the worship of the emperors as gods, then translates that into persecution against Christians as well. And things then politically turn for the next 200 years after that time. So anyway, this would be an appropriate way that Peter would talk about this. And I think in hindsight, obviously, we can look back and say, well, it wasn't the end of time. Because if it were, we wouldn't be here. So it's easy then to go back and go, well, whatever they thought it was, we can certainly see that there was an end of the world or the end of the heavens and the earth or something like that. This was a different end that Peter was referring to at that time. And then is basically saying it's a culmination of what the prophets and what the will of God was to bring about then the new age. I might remind you too, though, that in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul referred to his time as being the time upon whom the end of the ages has come. We are at the end, and I mentioned this last week, but we are at the end of God's redemptive time. Paul said it started back in his day. It's, of course, even more complete today than it would have been at his time. So important for us to look at it that way and consider what is going on. Of course, then, what Peter does is he begins there in 4 verse 7, he says, therefore. And he's going to give some quick hit types of things that Christians need to be doing because the culmination of all things is at hand. Is that would be a cool thing to just remember. You know, there's all kinds of things in the Bible you might at times take the quote and plaster it on your refrigerator or in your mirror, which is the two places you look the most, and I know I look the most. Well, not the mirror. That scares me to death nowadays. But at any rate, yeah, you're going to look there and you're going to say, hey, this is what needs to be going on in my life right now because indeed I'm living at the end of the ages and I need to be making this preparation. So he says, therefore, I want you to be. And he mentions two things right off the bat, self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. Let's talk a minute about this idea of being sober-minded. The idea is clear-mindedness, mental preparedness, if you will, bringing us in so that we are clearly every day aware of our condition, aware of where we are going and what we ought to be doing in light of the end of all things. I would say that it would be pretty easy for us to all admit that we get pretty involved in what's going on in this life, so much so we may forget, where am I? What's going on here? It's like driving down the road and your mind is going someplace else, and all of a sudden you come to and go, oh, where am I? Oh yeah, it's that exit. I think I know where I am. We need to center on every day knowing what we are here for. There's a mental preparedness about that. And as I thought about that, I would suggest there's two main things that keep us from having that clear-mindedness. One of them Jesus mentions over in Matthew chapter 6, verse 21 through 23, when he talks about what would cloud our vision. Listen to the words. He says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" Now please understand what he's saying there. He's not saying, well, some of you, if you could either be blind or you could see. Now, that's not what he's talking about. You can either see clearly or you have a terrible distortion in what you're seeing, and therefore what you think you're seeing, you're not seeing. That's the idea. When I used to go dirt bike riding, I didn't use glasses, and sometimes I couldn't tell the difference between a boulder and a shadow. And I was always hoping it was a shadow, because if it was a boulder, I was going to go flying. That's dangerous, is the distortion. So we look at life, there's a distortion if we allow, in this particular context, possessions to cloud our view, to cloud our thinking. And that is one of the easy ways then to no longer be clear-minded. The more we possess, and we all possess, the more we possess and the more we concentrate on possessing, the more unclear-minded we become, because we're spending so much time taking care of what we have. And it's just the way it is. It's the reason Jesus warned so strongly about how the rich, hello us in America, how the rich will struggle to enter the kingdom of heaven, because those things tend to take our mind away and keep us from being clear-minded and see what we ought to see. So both sin and possessions, either one and both, blur our eternal vision. They don't help us stay prepared. They don't help us stay sharp on the culmination of all things at hand and always being ready, because regardless of what that phrase may mean to them, we are temporary people, and the culmination of all things is certainly at hand for us as well. There's another thing that we need to see here, and it would be easy for us to read over the idea of self-control. I know that I think New Testament writers mention self-control so much, it's easy just to go, yeah, self-control, yeah, okay, whatever. Self-control is probably the biggest problem we have in America. And indeed, it's usually the biggest problem we can have in our lives. Self-control is so critical, because self-control is the foundation of maturity, and God is constantly pressing us to come to maturity. Self-control is the idea of being able to say no to self. And I think we would all agree on this. When a person doesn't have self-control, You could almost 100% point back and say, you didn't learn that when you were young, did you? That is where you learn it. You don't learn it later in life. What you do later in life, as many adults do, they struggle with it the rest of their life because they weren't taught it when they were young. As the Proverbs teach us, a child left to himself is a disaster area. They are full of fluff. They have to be taught and disciplined and trained if they are going to survive in this life. What is the first thing we want to teach a child? No. That's the first thing. Sometimes it's their first word. No. You will not touch that. You will not this. You will not that. Because what am I doing? I'm trying to protect you. But mostly, I'm trying to prepare you for a life that will be a disaster area for you if you don't learn to say no to yourself. And that is not something naturally learned. You don't learn it from society because society doesn't say no to themselves. You don't learn it any place else but in the home. A child left to himself, a child who manipulates parents to get his own desires, a child who is not repeatedly trained and disciplined to maintain boundaries, those children will not learn it, and they will become adults who will struggle the rest of their lives in that. We have fantastic families here, but never forget that. Because the bottom line is, you don't want to leave a legacy to your children where they're constantly struggling with self-control, saying no to themselves. You can't go to heaven without it. It's part of the character traits Peter will later talk about in his second letter that is a necessity in order to grab hold of eternal life. And as adults, even if you weren't raised to be disciplined and have self-control, it is an absolute necessary that you practice it. The more you practice it, the more you get good at it. But it must be practiced. It must be in the forefront of your mind. So being able first to say no to yourself, but there's more to self-control than just that. It's the idea of being able to prioritize responsibilities in your life. God is first. God is first. I have to prioritize that. My family, my wife, my children, these are priorities in my life. Making a living and working so I provide for them and provide for those who are in need is a priority in life. Grabbing hold of those responsibilities and fulfilling those responsibilities is self-control. It's discipline. I have to prioritize what's right. I cannot put my desires in place of those. And the other thing is just the ability to accept responsibilities and do a task till the end. How many of us as children? You know, you're told to do something and you do it halfway. There you go. My mother had come back and go, "You call this cleaning your room?" Well, I threw some things in the drawer and is it? No, this is not cleaning your room. And there is a idea of accepting a responsibility, knowing it's mine, and then being willing to complete the task. Goodness. Complete the task. And this again, when you think as a parent, you may be thinking in terms of, goodness, I just want this kid to get this done so I don't have to do it, but you need to look at it in the long term. My children have to learn to complete a task, and they have to learn to do it well. And that's discipline. That's self-control. That's not following the impulses of things that I would rather do. And that is, again, something that takes a life of parenting to cause that to happen. So extremely important principles for that to happen. Then notice what he says. This is for the sake of your prayers. That's an odd statement, isn't it? In some ways. There's one of the time Peter's used that. He used that with husbands, didn't he? 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7, he said to husbands, if you don't treat your wives right, you will hinder your prayers. Now he says, if you don't exercise self-control and clear-mindedness, then it's going to hinder your prayers. You need to do this for the sake of your prayers. Bottom line, the idea is, if I'm all over the place with what my desires are, if I don't say no to myself, if I'm not realizing my end goal and clear-minded and sober-mindedness concerning the culmination of all things, if I'm not doing that, I can say a lay me down to sleep prayer, but I'm not praying. I can't pray unless I prioritize things in life. And that's what Peter is saying. He says, no way without self-control, without denying self, without putting the cross in front of you, without knowing where you're going. Without that, you can't pray. You may think you pray, but you're not engaged with God and His desires. The end of this is what? In verse 11, in order that everything in God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. That's the critical key here. That's where I have to be going. And I have to be clear-minded and sober-minded with that and maintain self-control if I'm going to reach that particular end. Our prayers certainly aren't going to be effectual without that. And by the way, when's he talking? He's talking about during a time of suffering, especially. We need prayer all the time. But when do we really have to get to God in prayer? It is when we are under serious trials. And the last thing we want is to have a mess of a disaster of a life when the time of trial comes and we're not prepared. Reminds of the beginning of the book of Proverbs when he says, wisdom's crying in the street, listen to me. And the fool says, eh. And he says, the day will come when you will cry to me and I will not listen to you. Yes, everything goes down the drain when we haven't prepared ourselves for trial and we do not have a relationship with God in which we can truly pray. Now notice this. He goes on then in verse 8 and he says, above all, keep loving one another earnestly since love covers a multitude of sins. We of course, immediately notice the words above all. Above all else. Above everything. I am just so impressed with how many times Peter has mentioned this. And Paul mentions this. And John mentions this in 1 John. This is a repeated idea. Before Jesus leaves the earth, he says, you have to love one another. If you don't love one another, the world will not know you're my disciples. And so Peter goes, look, above everything, you need to love one another earnestly. We've mentioned this before. We know this. We've talked about this among us. That has been a failure of Christians in my entire life. It has to stop. It has to stop. We must, above all else, love one another. That is so absolutely critical. Will there be differences? Of course, above all else, love one another. We're not going to compromise right, but above all else, we're going to love one another. That is incredibly, how are we going to stand against the trials of the world if we're shooting one another? We can't shoot our friends. There could be no friendly fire in among God's people. So it is extremely important, and Peter keeps emphasizing that as a brotherhood of believers, not just in this body, but as a brotherhood of believers throughout the world, we are going to, above all else, love one another. And that's a constant pursuit. When you look at this word earnestly, the meaning is that we're going to love with an intent that is just absolutely pursued at all times. It is going to be pursued and persist even in the midst of difficulties, even in the midst of trials between personalities, trials between differences in various ways. That's always going to be. It happens inside our families. Should we be shocked if it happens inside our spiritual families? No, we should not be shocked. But we should respond like we would in our physical families. We're not going to let this divide us. We're going to go on with this. We're going to pursue this because that's what God did for us. He's pursued love for us even when we did some terrible things. This keep loving, and you notice that word keep there in the text? Keep loving. Peter, what are you saying? Well, loving for a little while is a piece of cake, but you got to keep loving. There's a persistence in love, and you're not going to give up. What did Paul say in 1 Corinthians 13? He said, love never fails. No, it hopes all things, believes all things. It never fails. Look at the proverb he quotes. This is a great proverb. Have you ever thought much about this proverb? But the proverb he quotes is Proverbs 10, verse 12. where he says, hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrongs. Now, in Proverbs, remember, that's Hebrew poetry. So words rhyme in the poetry. What's the two key words that rhyme in the poetry? The word stirs and the word covers. The word stirs and the word covers. They're contrasting rhymes. So he says hatred, when an event takes place that is tilts the matter of the universe between you and someone else, when some event happens that way, hatred stirs up and causes dissension. Hatred takes it to another level. Hatred creates more problems. What does love do? Love covers those things so that it does not continue. Love covers those things, does not make a mountain out of them. Love makes it so we're going to get to the end in loving one another and in glorifying God. And we have a greater goal than whatever puny event has caused the difference between us. And literally, in eternity's matter, what a puny event it would be. Imagine the things that you could think about in your life in which there has been things that tore the two of you apart or tore you apart from somebody else. And you get to eternity and you look at each other and go, man, we were both dumb as posts. Give me a break. We got all upset about what? And this is where we were going. And maybe we get to eternity and we're not sitting in heaven with each other because we hated instead of loved. Now, those are things that the proverb points out here. I love J.D. White. I don't even know who this guy is, but I found the quote. I thought it, you know, on this particular text. He says, a person acts out of love when a private personal injury has been done to him, as though nothing had occurred. In this way, by simply ignoring the unkind act or the insulting word, he brings the evil to an end. It dies and leaves no seed. This consideration gives dignity and worth inestimable to the feeble efforts of the most insignificant of us to make love the controlling principle in our daily lives. I thought good explanation of what we're talking about here. We're not going to allow these things to get in the way. The preacher in Ecclesiastes said it this way, do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All right, so quit getting your feelings hurt because you heard somebody said something because you've said something too. There's been times that you've said something too that you shouldn't have said. And even when we say those things, if somebody came to us, we go, you know, I didn't mean that the way that we say dumb things. We just do. We love better than that. We love more than that. And we should do that. Look also at this next statement, show hospitality to one another without grumbling. Interesting fact of showing hospitality. When we read other texts, a lot of times hospitality is indicated in a picture of someone who is a stranger, someone that is in need, that is maybe basically on the outside. Hebrews 13:2, entertain strangers, the writer says. For some have entertained angels unaware. Yes, there's that. But I want you to notice in this text the words one another. He uses them three times in the text. He uses them in verse 8, keep loving one another. Verse 9, hospitality to one another. Verse 10, using a gift to serve one another. These are one another texts right here. So now the hospitality that he's shown here, is not, okay, let me see, hospitality to somebody outside. It's a one another hospitality. And it's not exclusive to elders. It's not exclusive to certain parts of the group. It is something that he asks every Christian to do. I want you to show hospitality. Sometimes I grin a little bit with younger people today who say, well, you know, all I've got is a little one-bedroom apartment, or all I've got is that. And I've told some of you before, my grandmother and grandfather in their retirement years lived in an 8-wide mobile home, and they were the most hospitable people in the congregation. They didn't care. Everybody who was a visitor came to their house, and Grandma a lot of times didn't even have, she'd pull out leftovers from 3 days before, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this, and she'd make a meal. Nothing stopped her from showing hospitality. You don't have to have a mansion to show hospitality. Now you say, well, what is the great reason here? Why is Peter emphasizing this so much? Let's notice why that he does this. First and foremost, there are three, I would think, suggested things that I can see in Scripture that would make a difference in a congregation. When you invite somebody for dinner, how many times did Jesus go to dinners? Dinners and suppers were the time when love and good things happened. Dinners and suppers were something that tied people emotionally together. And he's calling upon the brethren, take these opportunities because you grow love in that intimate type of relationship. You grow love there. You speak about things and talk about things you wouldn't do standing in the foyer of a congregation. It's an inevitably important period of time. It's also for a time to provide for brethren who are traveling. John says that in 2 John and 3 John, one of the great emphasis that he makes there, to send them on and to provide for them. And then thirdly, extending hospitality, of course, during times of trials. People may lose a place to stay, maybe temporary, men may be even an extended time, even if it's not a trial. It's just a time of need for someone that you can help out. There's lots of different ways in which hospitality cements that love together, and every New Testament writer has emphasized it. Very, very important in showing love and doing what we ought to do. And then, notice, he didn't just say show hospitality. He said show it without grumbling. I chuckle when I read that. I always chuckle when I read that. Show it without grumbling. Everybody who uses their home to have people over, you know what he's saying here. You know what he's saying. There's so many various ways. Grumble because there's a lot of preparation. Could I just stop and say, well, I will anyway, whether you will give me permission or not. But could I just stop and say that a lot of you younger people, and I don't know who you are, but if you want me to say some names, I would. No, I'm kidding. Actually, you're a good group. Best young people, I told somebody before service, we're the best young couples here I've ever met in my whole life. They're fantastic. But please be warned. Somebody invites you to come to their house for dinner, and you say, oh, that sounds great. And that didn't mean to say you were going to be there. Don't do that. Don't do that. Thank you so much for the invitation. In your mind, you're thinking, maybe I go, maybe I don't. Don't do that. It's like Jesus' parables on the supper. You know, you go to all this work, and then you go, are they coming? I've had that happen so many times in other churches. Can't remember it happening so much here, but that happens. Please. Understand there's a priority here and there's a lot of work to be. So there's grumbling that can happen because of preparation. Grumbling because of the expense. Grumbling because of the inconvenience to one's schedule in order to show hospitality. This is not an easy work to do. Grumbling because of the wear and tear on your house. Oh, I don't want to have them. They have four children. grumbling because of those kinds of things. Or how about this one? Just grumble because God gave me this house and he expects me to use it. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Indeed, we are stewards, caretakers for the goods that God has given us. And we need to appreciate these are gifts, which is exactly what he brings up in the final section here. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever speaks, as one who speaks to the oracles of God, whoever serves as one who serves by the strength that God supplies. This is then a very important, but first and foremost, every one of us has a gift. Don't deny it. Don't say it's itty bitty. It's not very big. You have a gift. It needs to be developed. It needs to be encouraged. It needs to be something that you make better. The gift is usually a raw gift that needs to be shined up and used better, practiced. You have a gift. And God expects you to use it. Stop, give some meditation and prayer on what your gift or gifts are and use your gifts. None of us here have all the gifts. None of us do. So that's why gifts are complementary. We need to use them together. Secondly, we are to be stewards of the gifts. We're good stewards. A steward is a caretaker for somebody else's good. God has given them, like in the parable of the talents, He's given them to us briefly to use, and they need to be used before He returns. If they're not used, then He's saying, well, I'll just take it all away from you, like in the parable of the talents. We need to use the gifts. Very, very, very important. And He talks about two kinds of gifts, gifts of speaking. If anybody speaks, okay, you do some speaking. Everybody does some speaking. He's not talking about a Bible class teacher here. We all speak. But when we speak as the oracles of God, I would suggest that one of the most important ways we should speak when we're expressing concepts and views of the Scripture and exchanging thought with thought as we study, use biblical terms. As much as possible, use biblical terms. There's all kinds of ways that we can get sloppy with the use of terms. Simple example is somebody said, oh, you know, it was just a miracle. No, it wasn't a miracle. God may have done something, not taking away from that. God may have answered a prayer. God may have acted in any kinds of numbers of ways. But in a biblical definition, it wasn't a miracle. It wasn't some kind of suspension of natural law that you can put your finger on that God used in order to change someone's life. That's not the way the Bible uses it. Use biblical terms in biblical ways. Use it properly so that you stay with what the Bible has said. Be careful how we speak and when we speak. Otherwise, we can fall into this pattern that Paul talked about, those who are false teachers using plausible words of wisdom. You start with A, and then you go to B, and then you go to C, and then you go to D, and pretty soon it's so convoluted that you're not really speaking spiritual things. Had a conversation with a young person not too long ago, and they said, I was reading in Kings, and one of the amazing things is all these good kings, God says they did what was good in the eyes of the Lord, except they didn't tear down the high places. Well, isn't that interesting? That just indicates they're going to be in heaven and all of that, and you can get away with not doing the right thing all the time. I looked at him. I said, that's a big bunch of baloney. God stood on His head in Deuteronomy 12 and said, don't worship on the high places. I refuse to be worshipped like you worship the other idols. Now, you want to go into the thing about whether God's going to save King Asa or something like that? Be my guest. But that's not our end of the stick. We are to be a people who obeys Him. We are to be people who are careful to obey Him. We're not going to give excuses like, well, you know, maybe God saved so-and-so. And they did that. Well, that doesn't give me permission to do that. Never gives us permission to not be careful to obey what God said, to be sloppy in how we do that. When we speak, speak as the oracles of God. To everything, give glory to God. And when we act with the strength that God supplies. And there's only one simple question there. Are we spending our greatest strength in serving self and what we want to do? Or are we really giving the best to God? That's where our strength is going. It's going to serving God. And our ultimate goal then is so that in order in everything, God gets the praise and glory. Is my life doing that, or is it giving me the praise and the glory. So the great therefore is, the culmination of all things is at hand. And how should this change how we live? It certainly should. And there isn't any of us, boy, do I need this. We all need this to keep clear-minded, sober-minded, focused on what we have to do, because God has given us this great challenge. It won't be very long. Our study last week on time, it won't be very long. It's just a short time, and then we have all the time we could ever want. If you're not a Christian, if there's any way we can help you, we're going to sing a song right now. We urge you to take that opportunity or talk to us afterwards. Be glad to do anything we can help you. While together we stand and while we sing.